Warning. This story includes materials that are classified your ears only due to disturbing content. Other times we are quite silly and really just a hoot. Unless you were cleared for graphic depictions of sex, violence, or dirty words, this never happened. We were never here. It should go without saying that this is not intended for kids, but we're still saying it for their sake and for yours. We don't always play nice. You've been warned.
Sinister secret agents with shadowy employers and mysterious pasts. A bizarre landscape built from billions of minds. Arachnid-headed beings that guard a war-torn border zone. And all the worst that mankind has to offer, stalking the alleys and crumbling buildings of a place called Blue City. Is it a dream? Is it a nightmare? Or is it just a game? And are you already playing?
Actually, it's Lacuna Part 1, a tabletop role-playing game by Jared Sorensen. In 2010, a group of strangers who had never met in real life answered the call to participate in a text-based game called Lacuna, Slow Burn. None of us had any idea just how massive that story would become, or how much it would overtake our lives, let alone how far we were willing to go to keep that story alive. It's practically unkillable now. We are all very, very scared. Please help. I'm Don Fathom, a professional hypnotist and a writer. I help people think in new and interesting ways. Join me and my friends as we share an impossible story that will haunt your dreams, even as it toys with your sense of reality. Support this and my other projects at patreon.com/Don Fathom.
Lacuna Slow Burn starts now.
Warning. Classified material to follow. The following material is classified Deep Blue Clearance only. If you are below Deep Blue Clearance, disregard this document and return it to the nearest agency bureau. Destroy this document if there is any risk of it being compromised. Mission 1. Abusive. The words seem to jumble and fall apart. Only certain phrases are clear now, Barker's eyes watering, his fingers shaking as he struggles to read on. Voyeur. Glasses. Athletic. Clean. Invader. Violence. Physical violence or social cruelty. Strong. Alcohol. Running. Entry. Cassandra. Friendly, smiling, helpful. Pray with you. Accusing and angry. Violent, ignorant savages. They're having a night on the town. Interrogation of an agent. Agents discuss arming themselves, considering violence. Looks for signs of physical violence. Barker isn't sure why he's here. A chill fills the air around him. Letters turn to hieroglyphs before spiraling into a mess of incomprehensible text. The report is completely illegible now, paper covered in ever-shifting scribbles. Without the distraction, Barker becomes aware of his surroundings. A dark basement with boarded windows. A furnace and a water heater are his only company. A flight of concrete stairs lead up to a thick metal door above. Barker tucks the document away into his jacket pocket safely and buttons up, shivering a little. He rubs his eyes with the heels of his palms, taking a minute to sigh out his frustration, reflecting on the sheer absurdity of trying to read this message in this blank, black basement. He takes a deep breath and blinks himself to alertness, smoothing out his hair and straightening his suit jacket. Threadbare twilight from the spaces around the boarded windows and the glow from the furnace provide enough illumination to make out the shape of things, though any details will require close scrutiny. In the immediate space in front of Barker, a small penknife has been worn nearly to a nub. 8 neat tally marks have been gouged into the floor, in much the same way that a prisoner might count days. As he creeps along, Barker notices that his suit has been torn at the lapel. There's a deep ache in his right hip. The ribs and shoulder on that side of his body are very tender. Faint images of a man in a black suit tumbling down concrete stairs replays once in his mind. He notices a tenderness on the bridge of his nose as well. There are broken sunglasses at the base of the stairwell as he steps over. Barker looks towards the door at the top of the stairs and walks up quietly, listening carefully before opening and stepping through. The door upstairs has no give, or even a handle with which to push or pull it. It's reinforced steel, as solid as any other part of the wall, if not more so. He crams his thoughts with worries about whether he's going to have trouble with this voyeur or not, and if Cassandra is someone he can trust. Standing this close to the wall, Barker can see a few important details. From this side, the door swings inward. There are scratches here on the wall where it hits as the large metal leaf swings open. Taped into the corner, out of casual view, appears to be an old two-way radio with a single, unlabeled plastic dial. A note is attached, full of more garbles and meaningless scribble. Barker remembers the futility of last time and carefully returns to the basement floor, leaning his elbow against the wall slightly to keep the ache in his hip as undisturbed as he can while he eases himself down. Barker takes the knife and smooths his finger across the tip, carefully, to gauge how much use could be left in the knife, studying the etches in the floor. 8 days? 8 weeks? 8 guards? 8 attempts? He furrows his brow, trying to figure out how to get out of this mess. He slips the penknife in his front pocket and notes the radio. He wanders over to it and considers trying to lean the attached note into the light and read it. But after that last document, he feels too frazzled to try again. Barker decides instead to examine the radio carefully, turning the dial slightly to see what happens. The power switch depresses. Barker freezes, the suddenly loud static of the radio piercing the silence and stopping him cold. He adjusts the dial, trying to hone in and tune the static down, if not out. Hello? His voice shakes from fatigue and stress, hoping it'll pick up. A total of 13 channels click by, back and forth now, as Barker strains to find a human voice in all this white noise. Barker twists his brow in frustration, then closes his eyes and tilts his ear toward it instinctively as he listens carefully, twisting the dial slowly, trying to filter anything that could possibly be something familiar, anything not noise. Barker continues to scan the channels, occasionally pressing a smooth plastic button to attempt communication. Despite his best efforts, the radio only offers varying amounts of static. There's almost a hit on one of the channels, momentarily distinct and less cyclic clicks. As he hones in on them, they vanish. If he were to number the dial positions, the clicks appeared on channel 8, while the channel with the least interference, the quietest channel, is 3. Wait! There is something on channel 3. Very, very faintly, there's the sound of a bass line and a beat. Softly spoken lyrics can barely be picked out of the ambient noise. Something about distractions going on in another place. The beginning of the chorus to the Isley Brothers' Footsteps in the Dark. Just music, Barker thinks. But at least I know this thing's still operable. Barker probes around for any sort of volume knob or button, and should he find one, tests it gently just to see if it'd work before returning it to low. He changes the radio back to channel 8 and leaves it playing in hopes that something will jog his memory or catch his attention.
Inside the building, the lights are muted and the ceiling is low. The voices outside make it seem as if there are more people here, but the place is sparsely populated. There's the bartender, calmly polishing and then regarding a glass tumbler. Two drunk, conspiratorially hunched men in dirty overalls sit at the corner bar, nursing their beers between bouts of excited whispering. The tables to the left of the entrance are mostly unoccupied, except for the corner booth, occupied by a single lone woman in moth-eaten fur coat, frazzled brown hair sitting over her worn, wrinkled face. There's a jukebox to the right and even a small dance floor, though it seems to be gathering dust. To the rear is the door to a small single restroom. Coleman walks in and shadows Tucker, a bit to the left though. Agent Tucker turns to Agent Coleman. "Well, your bar, your show. I'm gonna kill some time." He strolls over to the bar and sits on one of the shabby stools. As the agent takes a seat, Coleman makes a short beeline toward the drunks. "Gentlemen," he says, looking one directly in the eye, "can I ask you some questions?" The men suddenly stop talking, turned inward and now peeking over their respective shoulders at Coleman. They glance at one another once more before the man on the left speaks. "I suppose," he says wearily. "What's this all about?" asks the other man. "We're all loyal citizens in here, sir." "Good," Coleman says with a nod, looking around and then regarding them again. It was a technique meant to put the men ill at ease, him glancing about as if he's waiting for something neither men seem privy to. "Really good. Loyalty is good. Look, I'm looking for somebody, someone. Someone who's dangerous, whose loyalties may be in question." He also goes into a description of the subject, and then he pauses. "Gentlemen, let's just say that any help you provide, well, this city alone will owe you big. And that's not even mentioning the other parties who might take notice." Schaffer takes in the scene as he and the agents drift through the doorway. The patina of decay that has settled over everything in the bar, including the patrons, engenders a feeling of sadness in him. He notices the drab woman seated alone, as well as the two blue-collar blokes conspiring at the bar. "Quite a menagerie," he says, searching a nearby table for an ashtray. Agent Schaffer finds silver ashtrays at the bar, as well as a few tables. All except for the one in front of the older woman are empty and clean. Transfixed by the woman sitting alone, Schaffer slowly approaches her table. "May I?" he says, gesturing towards the empty seat. "Sure," says the woman in a defeated tone. She takes a quick glance around, noting the other agents. "Divvying up the whole room between you, huh?" Tucker waits until the bartender gives him his attention and then speaks. "Hey, barkeep, what's going on?" The bartender sets his glass down for a moment to regard Tucker. He wears a plain, meditative look, a long face hovering over the white apron and thick, hairy forearms. "You here to talk, or are you here to drink?" he asks. The jukebox changes songs. "Magic Carpet Ride" by Steppenwolf. Tucker says, "Talk, I'm afraid. I can't drink on duty. We're looking for a very dangerous man. A particular one, mind you." He then goes on to describe the subject. "Seen anyone like that around here?" The bartender grunts. "Sounds like a fellow I've seen around recently. The guy wouldn't shut up about that fancy job of his and all the things he's going to do once he gets his finances straight. For what he spends on liquor, he's either got lots of finances or he hasn't got them straight." Tucker grins, finally feeling like he was getting somewhere. "A fancy job, you say? What is he, like a banker, a lawyer, an international super spy?" "Nah, not a spy. At least not a good one." "That's the weird thing," says the bartender. "With him talking it up so much, I just had to ask, and the guy starts getting defensive with me. Says he's under some kind of non-disclosure, something or other. So why you bring it up in the first place? Between you and me, some of these customers are crazy. Back in the waiting room, an agent comes in from Blue City, loosening his tie, laying back against a metal chair as he catches his breath. It's a good feeling, cooling his heels here as he waits to wake up on the slab. It gives him time to collect thoughts. The HP has given him the willies. Like any good CME agent, he's avoided direct contact, but he's gone on through dives to read all the signs. Neat, clean, quiet, overly friendly. The symptoms of a real psychopath. You'd have to dig deep to find that guy's baggage. There was an involuntary shudder as he imagined what one might find. They were actually going to give this mission to a fresh batch of junior agents? Upon arriving in the room, Turner's eyes are hidden by the dark tinted sunglasses, hiding the distant look. There's confusion there, disorientation otherwise masked by the confident way she carried her body. With her hair pulled back in a tight ponytail, she takes a seat on one of the chairs, flattening her knee-length black suit underneath her before trying to get comfortable. She gives the appearance of looking straight ahead, though her eyes dart about the room quickly. Turner reaches up and adjusts the collar of her suit coat, then runs her hands along the side of her head to make sure her hair is still properly smoothed back. A moment later, she is sitting still and upright in her seat, legs crossed over the other, with her hands resting on her knee. The weary man sitting a few chairs down gives a nod. "You're late," he remarks. "I'm guessing you were part of the bad insertion this morning. I could hardly get through. Is this your first mission? You got any questions? If you're lucky, you might even ask when I'm clear to answer for you." Turner shifts her gaze towards the man sitting down a few chairs, only noticeable by the slight turn of her head, being her eyes were well covered. She vaguely remembered the botched insertion this morning, which had indeed made her late. For what she wasn't exactly sure, she just knew she had to be here. The most obvious questions she asked first. Her voice was calm but curious as well. "Yeah, my first mission. I suppose I'd like to know exactly what that would be and just exactly who you are." "CME, ma'am. We're the ones who nose around for you blue clearance agents when there's a hostile personality in the area." The agent leans forward in his seat. "I'm 11. They give us different handles than you. They say it so nobody will confuse us green ties with you mystery agents. I personally think it makes it easier to keep track of fatalities. As for good questions, I'd lose my job if I told you what to ask. Questions are for blue clearance and up. I'm supposed to keep very, very mum about this stuff. But you do outrank me, so maybe you can think of something worth asking." He taps his wrist to indicate they don't have much time here. Behind her glasses, she looks down at his watch. If there was any hint of nervousness, she did well at hiding it. She was on the spot, and the questions just seemed to float around her. Finally, she pulled several out of the air at once. "All right, 11. What's our objective? Where are we going? Will we be meeting up with other agents once we're there? Are they, if anything, already briefed?" The green tie clears his throat. "I was told Agents Coleman, Tucker, Schaffer, and Turner would be present for the mission. I only counted three, so I guess one of those is you. The agents were last seen approaching the heights from the front entrance of the hotel. Late arrivals like yourself tend to get inserted directly onto the streets. Everyone is briefed before a mission, but you forgot most of it. You've got to get primed a few times before any of that sticks. Worst thing is, if you were told and you forgot, then they tell you again. You might get feedback. That means I can't share anything from the briefing with you. Besides, I only got the green clearance briefing, not the full blue clearance like you. Agent Turner finds she can't recall much at all before arriving in the waiting room. Everything in her head seems tattered and vague, but there was enough there to somewhat piece together. So the others are in play. Locate." She shakes her head and gazes at the man. "When do we leave?" she asks, straightening herself back up. For some reason, she kept feeling some strange light was going to shine down any moment and transport her someplace, and her head would be screwed on backwards. This is where to go when we're falling under and waking back up. I'm going to back to the slab, and from there, home. You will be leaving any moment for Blue City, he says as he looks around the room as if watching a cloudy sky for rain. You're not coming, she begins as if about to protest, then calms back down. Never mind, green level clearance. She resolves herself, then faces forward, away towards him. From behind one's shades, the glare is tolerable, as if envelopes the entirety of the room. The white of the walls, floor, and ceiling rapidly expands in every direction at once. See you back here on the flip side, Eleven. Somewhere in the distance, there was a strange hum and a sound like radio static. Insertion complete.
Barker sits down on the floor near the furnace, half listening to the radio. He examines his torn lapel, patting at the lost fabric and checking the rest of his suit for damages or blemishes. He flinches in slight pain as he twists, quickly straightening himself out. Side still hurts. Was I thrown? Did I fall? He quickly opens his suit to check for any wounds against his side, then decides to pad himself down and visually examine the more tender areas to make sure he's aware of any cuts or scrapes or bruises. There's the sound of breathing for a moment before a voice can be heard.
Could use some good news.
Barker perks and glances over at the radio, then half wonders if it's just picking stray noise. Regardless, he attempts to make communication with whoever is on the other end, trying to make sure he doesn't speak too loudly. Hello? Is anyone there? Can you hear me?
Identify your...
Barker hesitates for a moment, despite seeing some hope. Why would an operable radio be in a locked basement with me? I'm some sort of captive. If I've been in here 8 days, why haven't I found help with this radio yet? He takes a deep breath and continues communicating. It can't be worse than it already is, regardless of who's on the other end. He clears his throat to try and speak as clearly as he can through the static. You're breaking up. It's hard to hear you. My name is Barker, putting emphasis on his name. Can you understand me? He glances toward the door nervously. Scraping and dragging sounds reverberate from a room beyond the large metal door, as if furniture is being moved around. Footsteps shuffle around a bit before the dragging sound begins anew. Barker freezes for a moment, then quickly gathers himself and turns back to the radio. He takes the opportunity to raise his voice a bit amidst the scraping and utters hurriedly, "Stand by! I'll be back! Wait for me!"
What do you...
He clicks the radio off and returns to the center of the room, waiting and listening carefully to try and perceive what he can. He spots his broken sunglasses and places them in his pocket. He fingers the little knife he found earlier, considering probably too dull to make any effective use, but we'll see. Just breathe, Barker. With the radio off, Barker is able to follow the sounds as they cross the floor, heading first towards, then past, the large metal door. There is another far-off sound as a door is opened, then shut. At this point, Barker realizes that his heart is thumping hard and steady as if he's been jogging for a good 10 minutes. His breath is accelerated, muscles tensed, and if he relaxes, he might just fly off the ground. In this tense moment, fragmented memories begin to fill his mind. Barker waits for a moment, his own breath sounding all too loud. Should I wait? What if they're coming back in a moment? What if now's the perfect time? What if they're coming for me now? What about the radio? He blinks hard and rubs his face with both hands. He gives the door a long, hard look, then turns on the radio quickly. I'm sorry, there's no time. I've got to go. I'll try to talk to you soon. Barker takes out his knife and tries to cut or shred the radio out of the tape as best as he can and lays it on one of the bottom steps. He bounds up and presses himself against the door a few times briefly trying to gauge its strength, glancing around and feeling for hinges or cracks that he might be able to take advantage of. The door buckles with a fraction of Barker's potential effort. Now crumpled, it swings open, ripped at the hinges, the padlock that held him within now clattering to the floor. In his chest, his heart bounces about like a frantic tennis ball. Although the reservoir of strength and vitriol within him seems infinite, the resources of his mortally fragile shell are limited. If he pushes himself too hard, he may very well die.
When Agent Turner opens her eyes, the first thing she does is casually pat her body to make sure she was correctly placed in means of body parts. She takes a reassuring breath and then takes in her surroundings, looking down either way in front of her. She finds herself facing the scratched wooden doors of the bar. To the left and the right of the building, faces stretch along the generic city. 3 blocks to the left is what appears to be a large hotel and some kind of storefront. To the right, some 4 blocks ahead, tall trees and a large privacy wall protect a posh neighborhood. She wasn't the type to dilly-dally, so after her surroundings are clear, she steps forward and pushes open the doors of the bar. Back in the bar, Coleman says, "Gentlemen, let's just say that any help you provide, well, this city alone will owe you big. And that's not even mentioning the other parties who might take notice." "Saw him," says one. "Yeah," says the other. "Big spender. That's all we know." "Had a nice watch." "Yeah," says the man. "It had a bunch of weird symbols all over it." Turner enters the bar and with a slight motion of her head glances about the room. It isn't long before she spots what she was looking for as she proceeded towards the bar, where Tucker seems to be conversing with the bartender. Agent Tucker is momentarily stymied, but he still feels in the moment. "Is there anything else you can tell me about this man? Did he ever talk about his friends or family, or have any distinctive marks? Did he have any other favorite places to spend time? With money like that, perhaps a fancy restaurant, a club, a favorite girl, paid or otherwise. Did he talk about having big plans for the near future?" Bartender shrugs. "You about covered it on the looks. Clean shaven, good hair like he's going on some kind of date." The bartender thinks for a moment. "Except he was wearing jeans and a dirty white t-shirt. Reminds me of my kid, trying to act all suave but dressing like some kind of punk. He tracked mud in here," he complains. Tucker nods. "This is a pretty clean city, and I haven't seen any rain lately. Any idea where there would be mud around here?" He smooths his lapel, subtly drawing attention to his own device, and nods to Turner, then looks to Coleman and Schaffer and raises an eyebrow in their direction. The bartender shrugs. "It rains sometimes. It's not today," he says. "Could have been cleaning something, I suppose, or walking too close to the river." Turner walks up, though doesn't make a move to include herself in the group directly, instead staying behind and simply asking, "A bit late here. Have I missed anything?" Tucker waits for the bartender to finish talking before turning to the newcomer. "Just electric sheep. You are?" Tucker's brow arches from behind her sunglasses. "Name's Turner. You are?" Her eyes drift from the man before her to the bartender, who says nothing more than that. "Tucker," he replies, trying to figure out her angle. He'd find out soon enough, he's sure. But in the meantime, he looks her over once for an outwardly displayed lacuna device. Turner returns her own observant gaze of the man calling himself Tucker, before finally pulling the collar of her suit back to reveal the little device she was pretty sure he was looking for. If not, she'd have to deal with that later. "Just need to get the feel of the situation, Tucker," she informed. "You didn't catch a name, did you?" Coleman continues, not paying any attention to Turner as she enters. "Know where we might find him, or if and where he might show up anytime soon?" "Timothy," says one man. "Lee," says the other. "No, he said his name was Tim." The man on the right begins to rise from his seat. "I remember him saying Lee. The man on the left begins to rise from his seat. You calling me a liar? The two men face off, almost knocking Coleman over in the process of climbing from their stools. Tim! Lee! Coleman steps away from the two angry men and sighs heavily. Drunks can be fountains of information, but are also completely unpredictable. Gentlemen, he speaks aloud and authoritatively, sobering to some. I am on official business and do not have time for this tomfoolery. The man I'm looking for is an enemy to you and me and our way of life. Stand down right now. Neither of you are each other's enemy. Save that fervor for the real fighting. With a growl, the two men break off before working themselves up to fisticuffs. Thanks, says one of the men, right grudgingly. Thank maybe his name was Ray Lee. The other man shakes his head. Lee Ray, I'm sure. The man on the right glares for a moment. Could be, he allows. Bartender, a round for everyone. Another grunt. Two rounds. Let's not make any folks mad in here. The bartender looks over Tucker's shoulders to Turner. You drinking, ma'am? Tucker nods again. Thank you, sir. Is there anything else you remember about him? Yeah, he had a few drinks, says the bartender with a scowl. Thank you again, sir. Your information has been most useful. I'll put in a good word for you, Tucker promises the man without explaining further to who or why. He takes Turner aside and talks quietly. What are you doing here? I thought we had our full team. Why were you inserted separately? Muddy rivers in a city that never rains, sometimes. Turner shook her head on the offer of a drink. But was there something else about the drink? Barely having time to process the randomness of her own mind, she found herself once again in a one-on-one with Tucker. You'd think you'd appreciate the extra eyes and ears, but if you must know, several of us got stuck in the rabbit hole, she explained. The bartender sidles up to Coleman. Fancy a drink? You got two come in care of your buddies there, he says. Coleman says, no, sir, just some information. Know anyone fitting the description? For the love of God, says the bartender as he rolls his eyes. Didn't any of you come here to drink? He slams a hand on the table. I told your friend, so ask him. After a breath, he takes the mugs from the two men at the corner of the bar and refills them for a long, big oak barrel. He sets the drinks down in front of them, and they toast. The woman in the back orders herself something with a gesture, and the bartender brings her two glasses of wine. Schaefer smiles crookedly as he sinks into the seat opposite the lady. He removes his shades and lodges a cigarette between his lips. Lighting it, he says, we're trying to be as hospitable as possible. You know, get to know everyone, that sort of thing. My name's Schaffer, he says, extending his hand. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a few questions about a patron who frequents this fine establishment. We're looking for a chap named Richard Boyer. He's 28 years old, Caucasian, short brown hair, glasses, athletic build, clean cut. Sound familiar to you? Yeah, I saw him, she says. Men like that ain't much interested in old ladies like me. Sounded like a real bragger anyway. Gave me the willies. Way too nice. It looked to me like he was casing the place. Probably some kind of thief or con artist or something. She gives Schaffer a knowing look. Do you have your papers, young man? She says. When did you see him last? Says Schaffer, perplexed by the woman's question. Did he happen to mention where he resides? Nope. She gives an insincere smile. Here, let me show you my papers, comrade, she says as she rummages around in her purse. She withdraws an envelope and extracts a paper covered in strange, ever-shifting symbols with no real discernible meaning. She wipes a red wing from the table with her sleeve before setting it neatly in front of Schaffer. At most, Schaffer understands that there is a kind of letterhead at the top, and perhaps some sort of information here on the right column isn't letters at all, but a series of indecipherable numbers. Is that good enough for you? Schaffer studies the spidery letters on the woman's papers and, perplexed, says, that will do. He smiles again and says, how often did you see him in the bar? Was it frequently? That is a letter from a creditor offering cheap, no-frills loans. I'm not answering any of your questions, Schaffer. If you don't leave, I might even tell them about you. A blank, predatory calmness settles over Schaffer's face. He takes a final drag from his cigarette and gently stabs the ashtray with it. He regards the old woman with insect eyes and says, "Your threats are utterly meaningless to me. You're welcome to tell whomever you wish about my comings and goings." His voice is cold and even in timbre. "If you wish to be impertinent, that's your prerogative." He leans forward and his face congeals. Menace radiates coldly from his eyes. He snatches the piece of paper and crumples it. "If there's anything else that you need to tell me, you had better unburden yourself, for I will make your life intolerably painful if it comes to light that you're aiding or abetting the man that we seek." He leans back. "Have I made myself clear?" The woman considers Schaffer's words, continuing to scowl. The woman swallows whatever barb she had prepared in retort. "Of course, comrade," she says respectfully as she stares ahead. "The individual was a visitor like yourself. Your companions have been outspoken in this tiny bar, and yes, he matches all of your descriptions, though I doubt his name was Lee Ray. Sure was dirty, smelled a bit too," she thinks. "On his face, I saw a wild, excited look. It was as if he was getting ready to do something bad. The only place I can think of with wet dirt around here is in the heights. You know, sprinklers, pools, big yards, and trees. I think that's where he was, and I think he was planning on returning." Schaffer flicks the crumpled paper towards the old woman and stands up. "Thank you, madam. You've been quite helpful." The edge of his lip twitches upward like the tail of a cat. "Enjoy the rest of your evening." He adjusts his collar and approaches his colleagues.
"Excuse me." Coleman follows the bartender, staying on the patron side of the bar. "Sir, I am on official business. I just asked you a question, and if you do not come..." There's a thumping sound, seemingly from everywhere at once, and all of the agents feel a change of air pressure. It's as if this bar were the cabin of a rising airplane or a sealed chamber sinking beneath the water. Then Coleman pauses, as if goosed. He opens his mouth impossibly wide and sticks a finger in one ear. "What the hell? What was that?" He turns and looks at Tucker, still jiggling his finger in his ear. As Coleman's voice raises, the jukebox is bucked a few inches into the air. It hits the ground with a dull thud and a slide, startling the two men at the corner of the bar. The old woman just sips her wine as she savors the agent's reactions. The song is "Footsteps in the Dark" by the Isley Brothers. Experiencing the pressure change, Schaffer turns to his closest colleague and says, "We best make our way out of here, I think." Agent Tucker nods his agreement and quickly walks out the door. Schaffer follows Tucker as expeditiously as possible. Coleman then looks oddly at the bartender, and as the other agents file out of the bar, he walks backwards, giving the barkeep a suspecting look. The bartender bobs his head to the kick and bass line as a soulful voice fills the speakers. It's a song about fading love, diversion somewhere else, and the sound of footsteps falling just beyond light's reach. The payphone outside of the bar is ringing. Turner was trying to think if there was anything from control. Was there? Though the idea was quickly fleeting when the room began to change, by the time she walks out of the streets, she has almost forgotten the question. Stepping outside, Turner notices the phone but ignores it and allows someone else to answer. Instead, she starts off, then remembers she has nothing in the way of leads and is flying blind other than a few bits of information. Glancing around, she tries to spot anything she could see that might prove useful. As Agent Tucker makes his escape from the bar, he notices the phone ringing and stops to answer. "I could use some good news, Control." On the phone, there is a sound like heavy breathing and shoes scraping on concrete. A chill creeps down Tucker's spine. Someone says,
"Hello? Is anyone there? Can you hear me?"
Tucker's heart drops. "Caller, identify yourself." Static plagues the line.
"You're breaking? Barker. Can you understand?"
Tucker cups his hand over the receiver. "Barker? Who are you? What do you want?"
"Stand by. Wait for me. I'm sorry. There's no time. I've got to go. I'll try to talk to you soon."
Within moments, an irritating tone plays over and over again. indicating the call has been terminated. Agent Turner is the first to notice the passers-by. They are unusually friendly, gesturing warmly as they make their way past the group of agents. "How is everyone doing?" asks a rather portly woman in a bird's nest hat. "Oh, excuse me," she says courteously, bypassing the agents to make her way into the bar. Turner's brow arches as she catches sight of the woman. Her appearance was somewhat odd. Why would a woman like that go into a bar? Crazy, maybe? She takes a few steps after the woman and before she can step inside, calls out, "Excuse me, ma'am, might I ask a few questions, please?" The woman stops short of the large oak door that leads into the bar. "Why, sure," she says, surprised and delighted as if she's been stopped by a friendly reporter. "Ask away." Turner looks the woman over briefly before proceeding with her questions, politely directing them one at a time. "Thank you, ma'am. Do you come to this place often?" Her question comes with a subtle gesture towards the bar. "Well, I don't know if I'd say all the time," the woman says, blanching slightly. "But I stop by a few times a week for half a glass of wine. I'm meeting a friend here today." "A friend, you say," Turner states, though refraining from questioning the identity of said friend until later. "In the times you've come, have you noticed anyone out of the ordinary? A man that might have looked out of place or acted strangely?" "The only stranger I've seen is that new bag boy at the grocery store. Well, that and all you exterminators," she says. She gestures at the bar. "Is this place full of bugs too?" she asks. "Exterminator," Turner repeats, letting it process completely. "You've seen others like myself. Do you see any of them here with me now?" she asks, pointing out those she knows of around her. She didn't know if the bar had a pest problem. She thought better of answering in case it turned out to be a lie. "Well, that's how I understood it. Yes, I saw the other exterminator in the Heights this morning. Aren't you all from the same company?" "Can you tell me what this other exterminator looks like, ma'am? We have reason to believe he's using bogus chemicals on jobs. Might be dangerous," she lies coolly, though wanting to make known the situation was serious somehow. "I caught him snooping around the Heights, a smart suit, sunglasses. I mean, he looked like a proper exterminator to me," she says matter-of-factly. "It was an older, distinguished gentleman with a bald pate and a slightly pudgy face. He said his name was Mr. Wagner. He was looking for his partner, a Mr. Barker, if I'm remembering it right." Turner smiles at the woman and gives her a nod. "Thank you, ma'am. You've been very helpful. Now, you also mentioned a new bag boy." Tucker turns to the group. "Well, there's a guy, probably named Barker, who wants us to wait for him. I don't know why. I don't know when. I don't know where. Any thoughts?" "Perhaps we should wait right by the phone and hope that Barker contacts us again here," says Chaffer, lighting a cigarette. Tucker nods. "That'd be the obvious choice, but we have no guarantee that he'll show, or even that we'd want him to. I was thinking we could split either 3-1 or 2-2 and send the larger half to check out the Heights. That way, at least we're not losing time, and if the target is there, he's still outnumbered. I could stay here, Coleman can do what he wants, and you could take Turner to the Heights." He looks at Turner, chatting up another local, and mouths to Chaffer, "If you trust her." "Smart plan," says Chaffer, staring furtively at Turner, and says, "Trust is a relative term. I have equal reason to trust and to distrust." He smiles and tosses his cigarette into the street. "I don't mind venturing to the Heights if you'd prefer to stay here." Tucker smiles genuinely the first time he recalled this trip. "True that. I figure it's a bad example to suggest leaving someone behind, not volunteering to be it. I just hope this guy shows up soon. We should catch up relatively quickly. As for the rest of the group composition, I know you can get the job done. She's just your backup." A flock of starlings, small, dark, tightly grouped and synchronous, scoops down from above, over the high rooftops as a mass of wings cutting air, vanishing into the trees above the rock wall, enclosing the Heights. Chaffer slowly and warily approaches Turner as she begins questioning the pedestrian. He is sure that his approach is not overt enough to catch the lady's attention. He waits patiently for the questioning to conclude. Lighting another cigarette, he watches the last of the starlings carve across the Baroque, smoke-stained buildings. Turner pauses as Chaffer approaches and offers him a quick smile before extending her own hand to shake his. "Agent Turner,
This woman has been helping in our investigation of that rogue exterminator, she hints, gesturing toward the woman. Just one last answer and I think we can be on our way. Well, all the girls are talking about the bag boy, says the woman in the hat with a laugh. Nice enough of a young man. Plays a good game of football and he gets good grades, he does. A handsome fellow, too. I was thinking of introducing my niece to him. And do you think this bag boy arrived around the same time as your exterminator? It was probably nothing, but she wanted to make sure. Where does this young man work? He's been working at the grocery store for a week now, says the woman in the bird's nest hat. Not to be rude, miss, but I'm expected, she says, indicating she's ready to go into the bar. Thank you for your time, ma'am, Turner says with a smile as she nods the woman off. Turning to Chaffer, she asks, with a hint of curiosity, you think the bag boy is worth checking out? I think so, says Chaffer. We shouldn't leave any stones unturned. He smiles thinly. I presume that this grocery store is located in the Heights, correct? The door is closing behind the woman as Chaffer wonders out loud. The Heights beckon. Chaffer walks that way. Turner just shakes her head a little. She didn't know for sure, but had a feeling the flow was taking them elsewhere now. One had to be quick in this place. To the Heights we go, she speaks to herself out loud, then follows behind Chaffer. The payphone is ringing again. Tucker answers the phone. Hello? Who is this?
This is Control. I have six people on the slab here, but only four blips on my screen. Barker's vitals are out of sync and his heart rate is rising fast. Can we get a status update?
Tucker yells into the phone. Six? Who's the sixth? And who the hell's Barker? Nothing was going his way. The only thing he had to look forward to was slamming the receiver down on the hook in about 5 seconds. There's a pregnant pause.
Scratch that. I have five agents and the subject. My mistake. You're telling me you don't know who Agent Barker is? Didn't you do a roll call when you arrived in the city? I can't believe these
The line muffles. A few indistinct words are uttered before the voice becomes clear again.
Aren't in sync with Barker when you meet up, there's going to be hell to pay. I don't care what you do or how you do it, just increase static by 4 degrees.
The words strike Tucker like a knife in the back. He takes a deep breath, trying not to react, and says into the phone, Roger that, Control. Orders acknowledged, over and out. Then he smashes the receiver against the hook and kicks the side of the booth a couple of times for good measure before turning to Agent Coleman. Situation has changed. We're getting the hell out of Dodge. But Agent Coleman is gone. Tucker proceeds to the Heights. Greetings, junior agents. When you begin Lacuna Slowburn, your identity consists of an age, gender, a single name pseudonym, and a mission. Apprehend the hostile personality. Transport it to the Lacuna. And even those instructions are missing steps. They teach you one simple technique and give you a general idea of how much your heart can take in a single mission before it breaks, mentally, physically, or even bureaucratically. Otherwise, agents know nothing of who they are or where they really come from, which means that so much of who an agent is more about the decisions they now make. I think we forget sometimes just how much of who we are is based on our actions, not the opinions we have carefully crafted of ourselves. Consider this. Who are you? When you forget where you put your car keys. When you forget where the car is parked. When you forget the words to a song you once knew.
When you forget, you are dreaming. When you forget your own name and everything connected to it. We all rely on the assumption that all of that will still be there when you think to check for it, even if it was totally out of your mind for a moment. Who are you in the moments when you are not thinking or feeling anything in particular at all, and you're not actively accessing your memory or focused on a particular thought or feeling? And who are you right now? What are your mission objectives? Who do you work for, agent? Remember, even when you're not sure who you were or who you want to be, you are still exactly who you are right now. And there's so much more to you than just what you remember or how you feel. Who am I? I'm Don Fathom, a writer and a professional hypnotist. I help people understand their fears so they can overcome them. Please join our Patreon to support this endeavor and other projects as we continue to expand our influence over the unsuspecting masses. You'll get access to all my classified materials and a bunch of stuff I made up, because let's be honest, they're all the same thing, really. Discover things the public just isn't ready for. Experience the thrill of fictionally endangering yourself on a daily basis. Remain in a state of constant paranoia. Get bonuses, exclusive materials, early releases, and live broadcasts, all this and more at patreon.com/DonFathom. That's DonFathom. We're on social stuff too. Check it all out. We're Midnight Police on YouTube, TikTok, X, and Facebook. On Instagram, we are The Midnight Police. That is The Midnight Police. Get it right. You've been warned. This week's episode was written by myself, Matt Kimmel, Ian Bloom, and entities working under the pseudonyms Agent Chaffer, aka Older Cloud, Agent Turner, and Agent Coleman. This episode was read by Don Fathom, Matt Kimmel, Ian Bloom, and Agent Chaffer, aka Older Cloud.
All content from Lacuna Part 1, Second Attempt, is copyrighted by Memento Mori Theatrics, all rights reserved and whatnot. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Non-Derivative 4.0 license. Quick review, agents. That means you can copy and distribute Lacuna Slow Burn as long as you give us appropriate credit and you do not change it or use it for commercial purposes. If you do, we'll sick the Spider-Man on you. Or something even worse. Lawyers.
That concludes this episode, Junior Agents. But you'll be back soon. Almost as if you never really left.